Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello, good evening, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. I am Neil Denny and my guest tonight is Charles Fernyhough. Charles Fernyhough is a writer and psychologist. The Baby in the Mirror, his book about his daughter's psychological development, was translated into seven languages. He has also written two novels, The Auctioneer and A Box of Birds. He is a reader in psychology at Durham University and has written for The Guardian, The Financial Times and The Sunday Telegraph. And his latest book is Pieces of Light, The New Science of Memory. So I'm talking to Charles Fernyhough. Charles, thank you for talking to Little Atoms today.
It's a pleasure. Good to be here.
So we're going to be talking in the main about your recent book, Pieces of Light, The New Science of Memory. I guess the first thing to say about Pieces of Light is it's not a straightforward popular science or pop psychology book. You weave in a lot of autobiography. And so let's talk about why you've taken that approach, first of all.
Well, to me, autobiographical memory, the memories we have for the stories of our own lives, is all about stories. It's all about the stories we tell about the past. And so you've got to get into memory from the inside, as it were. You've got to find out what's really going on for people when they relive these experiences. And so just telling the story of the science, just relating lots of scientific information is important, but it wasn't the way I wanted to approach doing this book. I wanted to let the stories speak for themselves.
Despite that, I'd like to talk about very briefly about some of the science, first of all, but mainly in terms of, I'd like to look back on the history of the study of memory and what early research was like. How long have we seriously been studying memory?
Well, memory has been studied systematically from the, you know, from the end of the 19th century, but people took different approaches to it. So a body of, you know, an approach that became well established was simply presenting people with lots of information, you know, lists of nonsense syllables and seeing how well they would recall them. And it's only relatively recently that we've gone back to looking at the subjective experience of memory and to looking at the stories that underlie it.
As we work through the separate parts of the book, then we'll look at the science as it crops up along with autobiographical bits. So we'll start right at the beginning. And in the first chapter of the book, you go back to Cambridge, where you went to university after an absence of some years and wander the streets and deliberately get lost. Let's talk about what this tells us about how memories are constructed.
I thought looking at how what happens in our minds and our brains when we get lost was quite a nice way into the question, because when you are moving through time in memory, you are sort of navigating a landscape, and you've got to learn to navigate that landscape as a small child. And being lost in memory is something a bit like being lost in space. So I thought that would be a good way in. But also finding your way in a landscape does involve remembering and finding familiar certain contexts and places, as well as doing all the sort of computations you need to do about the spatial layout of the world you're moving through. The passage you're referring to simply involved me getting lost in a place that I should have found incredibly familiar. You know, I knew this place very, very well, and I could have found my way across it blindfold and drunk on a dark night. So I was suddenly struck with the experience of being in a place that should have been so familiar, where I couldn't find my way. You know, I couldn't work out which turning to take to get to a particular place. And it's this sort of, you know, boring kind of lostness that happens to all of us all the time. But what it allowed me to do was to address a particular point about familiarity, the familiarity of the landscape. So what I describe walking down a particular alleyway, turning to look at another vista, and then turning back to that alleyway and thinking, now, is that familiar? And of course, it was familiar because I'd seen it a few seconds before. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know whether it was anciently familiar, you know, whether that familiarity had any real depth to it. So the question of whether you can distinguish what's newly familiar from what's oldly familiar was what was preoccupying me then.
Well, I think at that point, you're describing that scene in that alleyway, we should probably bring in, I was going to bring this up later in the interview, but let's talk now about this, you know, this idea of the sort of latest theories of memory, the idea of the reconstructive theory of memory. So basically, using that scene in the alleyway, we can describe how memories themselves are actually constructed, looking at a scene that you would have recognised from the past, but at the same time, that memory is being constructed in the present as you're actually there looking at it.
Yeah, exactly. Rememberings are rememberings of rememberings. You know, memories are memories of memories. I was both remembering something from the distant past, but also I was remembering something from more recent in time, and of course I'm ultimately remembering that event. So this is what's happening all the time in memory. It's one of the reasons memory is so tricky. We can never access the original moment. Very, very rare occasions can we really get back to a kind of unmediated memory of a past event. Usually what's happening is we're remembering having remembered that thing before, and all sorts of errors can creep in when that happens. You can end up integrating bits of information that really shouldn't be in the memory, sticking them into the memory, and then they kind of overwrite what was there before, and so that becomes part of the new construction.
At some point, I guess when an event first happens, there is a created like a sort of, I guess, a sort of meta memory, the first memory of that thing happening. So what actually happens to that? Because presumably all the elements of that memory are somewhere.
This is one of the puzzles, which I don't think we've resolved, the issue of forgetting. What happens when you forget something? Now, the reconstructive view of memory suggests that what we do when we recall something is that we don't just kind of pull a file down off the shelf, which corresponds to that event. What we do is we pull together lots of different kinds of information into a new construction, a new collage, which is shaped by who we are now as much as what we actually remember of that past event. So it's like the bits come together, then they're scattered through the period of storage, and then they come together again. What's happened to the memory when it's not integrated like that, when the bits are scattered around? That's a good question. Can you really be said to have forgotten the memory or not?
And then we go back to that, the filing cabinet or the hard drive metaphor. Presumably those things do exist somewhere. They're in there somewhere.
Yes, but the bits that we store have different qualities. They're different kinds of information. So, for example, we store sensory impressions. We store perceptual fragments, in our occipital lobes at the back of the brain, for example. We store the visual elements that make memories very often so visually rich and distinctive and vivid. But we store other bits of information as well. We store information about who we were at that time, a kind of autobiographical semantic memory. So if I asked you to recall your first day at school, you'd come up with those visual impressions and some auditory impressions as well, perhaps. But you'd also use information like the fact that you lived in this particular house at that time and you were in this particular town between these particular dates. And so you're going to bring that into the memory as well. That's going to be involved in the reconstruction process as well.
You've asked me about my first day at school there, and my first day at school is bound up with being stung by a wasp. The very first thing I remember of being at school is I sat on a wasp. And so there's a traumatic event, and often our memories we'll talk more deeply about trauma later on in the interview. But, right here we can talk about how a particular event of my recalling is linked to something quite traumatic. And actually, if I try and remember anything else about my first day at school, beyond those other details, which is that I know the address of that school, I know where that school was, I know where it's located, but apart from being stung by a wasp, I have no other memories of that day.
Interesting. You got off to a bad start with school then, didn't you? and very often these very early memories of ours are memories of humiliation. Strong emotions that often involve some kind of social evaluative component. So for me, the one I talk about in the book was of having an accident, a toilet accident on the stairs in my house. And, it's a really clear memory, and it's not something I ever discussed with anybody for obvious reasons. So painful, emotional, and particularly humiliating events are often very well remembered.
You do talk in the book as well, though, about how childhood memories themselves often do tend to be particularly vivid. There's this image of childhood memories being bright and full of light in the book. So let's, before we sort of talk about why that may be, talk a little bit about the development in a child of the ability to have memories. How does that come about? How do we develop the neurological infrastructure to have the memories in the first place?
At this moment in time, I think we really do not know. What we know is that people don't remember their childhoods. They don't remember much before the ages of about 3 or 4. And there are all sorts of reasons why this might be the case. It might be because of language. It might be because of the development. You need to have a particular idea of self to do memory. It might be because you need to be able to read the minds of others and understand your own mental processes. Most recently, it's been suggested that the key limiting factor is narrative, the ability to order information in a temporal frame to tell a story effectively. Probably all these things need to be in place. They don't get in place until about age 3 or 4. So that might, that might account for the fact that the offset of childhood amnesia happens at about that time. But there are all sorts of other puzzling things that are going on. And you mentioned the neurological development that was proposed as a reason why we don't remember our childhoods. But babies do remember stuff. They remember things from being from 6 months to 18 months, for example. they do have memory, so the structures must be in place to remember. Curious findings, like some recent research, suggests that, yeah, for most adults, you don't remember much further back than 3 or 4. But if you ask children, you ask an 8-year-old child, for example, they're likely to come up with memories from much earlier on, from age 1 or 2. And so it can't simply be that something dramatic happens at age 3 or 4 that allows us to start remembering. It can't be as simple as that. And to be honest, at the moment, we don't really have a good theory of that.
Let's talk about the idea then of childhood memories being particularly vivid.
Well, I was struck reading accounts of early memories and also talking to my own children about their early memories, how full early memories are of light, of bright light. And because vision is a very salient sense, it's very immediate. Because bright lights, you know, are particularly intense examples of visual stimuli, it's perhaps not surprising that they figure in very early memories. If you've got a system that's just learning to lay information down in that way, then it's not surprising that the most striking, vivid sensory impressions are the ones that stick. And you find this in people's descriptions of early memories. You also find it's become quite well established that there are early kinds of memories called fragment memories, which don't involve any kind of narrative structure. So when people say their earliest memories are not a particular event, but a particular image or a particular emotion, this is quite a common finding, that people can recall further back if they're just asked to focus on an image or an emotion compared to if they're asked to describe an actual event.
Talking there about vision being a good sensory stimulus leads us on to the obvious other sensory stimulations that you talk about in the book, and the idea that smells and sound are particularly good stimulants for memory. Let's talk about that idea.
The idea that smell gives you a particular route into the past is often associated with Marcel Proust and the famous scene in A la Recherche du Temps Perdu, where he tastes a bit of a madeleine cake soaked in lime-scented tea, and the story goes he's immediately transported into his childhood at Cambrai. Actually, if you read what Proust writes, he says that what happens when he tastes the madeleine is he's overcome by an emotion. He's overwhelmed by this strange emotion that he can't put a name to. He doesn't understand it. And it takes some time before he's able to kind of interrogate that emotion and make the connection, the cognitive connection, to the actual memories. And so it's a mistake to think that what happened in that scene in Proust was a sudden catapulting back into the past. Although that does happen in some cases. I talk about a case in my book where somebody I knew who smelt the cigar ashtray that her grandmother had used to use, and it was immediately transported back into that time. So whether there's anything special about smell, people for a long time have been saying there is something special about smell, perhaps because of the way smell works in the brain. The olfactory lobes are very close to the bits of the brain that do memory. And there's a very direct route into the olfactory lobes through the relevant sensory epithelium. So maybe that's something to do with it. I'm not entirely convinced by that idea. I think there's also evidence that music, as you mentioned, is a very, very powerful cue to memory as well, and can perform the same task of throwing us back into the past in the same way. One thing we know about smell, though, is that it does shift what's called the reminiscence bump. The reminiscence bump is what you would see if you remembered everything you possibly could about your life and ordered the memories according to the dates at which they happened, according to the time in your life when it happened. You'd find a bump, a peak, in your late teens and early adulthood. Most people remember most stuff from that period of their life. And if you cue people with words or with visual images, they tend to generate more memories from that part of their life. But if you cue them with smells, that reminiscence bump is shifted back to much earlier in childhood, around about 8 or 10. And so it does seem there's something special about smell in allowing us to access earlier memories.
You mentioned the idea of the olfactory system being linked sort of more directly into the brain. And when I was reading that section of the book, I was also reminded of a lot of traumatic memories of my own being linked to particularly smells. And there's also this, I don't know, like a folk memory or a sort of atavistic memory of that we know that off food we should avoid and dead bodies because of the smell. And perhaps those things are linked in some way.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. I mean, you know, we know that animals of all sorts will quickly learn to avoid a particular odd new taste. I mean, the memory system in general is attuned to novelty. It looks for things that are new. And so it's possible that certain smells and tastes are striking because they've never been encountered in the way that other visual stimuli, for example, would have been encountered before in some similar form.
We touched on the reconstructive idea of memory. I want to talk now about the experiments of Elizabeth Loftus in particular, and let's talk about how easy our memories are to fool.
Loftus is usually associated with what's become known as the misinformation effect, where by feeding experimental participants particular bits of information, you can get them to integrate them into their memories. And so one example of a study done about 10 years ago, involved researchers contacting the parents of the student participants they were planning to work with and asking for a couple of things from the parents. Firstly, asking the parents for some photographs of the student when they were a child, but also checking certain facts like whether the student had ever been up in a hot air balloon. And this is all done without the student's knowledge. And then what happens is that the students are asked into the lab and they're shown some photographs. And some of them are the genuine ones from the people's childhoods, but others have been doctored, they've been photoshopped. And in particular, what they did is they photoshopped the students into, as children, into the basket of a hot air balloon. So people were seeing a picture of themselves as children in a hot air balloon. And a surprising proportion of these students, after having viewed these images and talked about them, when they came back a couple of weeks later, about half of them had vivid memories of this hot air balloon ride that the experimenters were absolutely certain had never happened, because that had been corroborated by parents. So it's quite doable to give people vivid memories for something that's never actually happened. And Loftus and her colleagues have extended that into giving people quite elaborate, detailed memories of, for example, being lost in a shopping mall as a child, when they can verify that this hadn't actually happened. But just simply by talking about the event in a certain way, presenting the information about the event in a certain way, you can lead people to have vivid memories.
Talk then about how we're able to distinguish, you know, what is the difference from an actual real memory that happened to us to something that we just imagine happened to us, whether or not that's something that's been implanted or whether or not it's just a dream or our imagination. How do we tell the difference?
That's one of the ways in which memory is tricking us all the time. So, for example, it's quite common, I think, to dream something and then to experience it as a memory. And telling the difference between real and imaginary memories is actually pretty tricky. It's been interpreted within the framework of what's become known as the source monitoring paradigm in psychology, where the cognitive task is to distinguish between something that was internally generated, in other words, imagined, versus something that was externally generated, in other words, that actually happened. And there's a sophisticated theory about how memory works based on how hard it is really to make that distinction. Some people claim to have found neuroimaging evidence that allows you to distinguish experimentally between real and imaginary memories. There's evidence that certain parts of the brain, particularly in the anterior medial prefrontal cortex, right at the front of the brain, just behind the forehead, there's evidence that that area of the brain is very important in this process, but it's something we're still learning about. And generally speaking, it's quite hard to tell the difference between a memory that somebody comes up with because they've been asked to come up with an imaginary memory and a genuine memory.
I'm sort of leading us down the way to talk about the idea of recovered memory. You know, these various therapists have basically uncovered memories that didn't necessarily happen. And I guess this sort of leads us on to talking about trauma and people that cope with trauma. And there's a long section of the book where you talk about post-traumatic stress syndrome. And so let's talk about how our memories deal with traumatic events that happen to us.
There's no doubt that events that are more emotional get remembered better. The question here is there something fundamentally different in the case of trauma? When somebody is traumatized, does their memory work in a totally different way? That was always the idea that came out of Freudian psychoanalysis, that there were a different set of mechanisms that came into play when a trauma had happened. At the moment, there's no good scientific evidence that that's the case. Everything about trauma memory can be explained in terms of ordinary memory processes. But because the event is so extreme and because it is so packed full of emotion, the memories can be very, very persistent and they can get very distorted as well.
I just have one other thing to talk about Pieces of Light, and then I want to move on and talk about your novel, A Box of Birds, briefly. But this idea that in talking about conditions that affect people's memory, for instance, people that suffer from brain damage or forms of amnesia, there is this idea that comes out of it that our memories, our ability to have memories, is connected to our ability to imagine a future for ourselves as well. So tell us about that idea.
Some of the most interesting recent research on this topic has been about looking at connections between casting your mind back into the past and throwing yourself forward into the future. And lots of different things came together. And in actual fact, this turns out to be a very old-fashioned idea. And I mention in the book how medieval writers on memory seem to have the same kind of idea. Memory wasn't just about recalling the past. It was about doing something new. It was about being creative, being recombinative with the information that you had. But one bit of evidence that's come to light in recent years is that people with hippocampal amnesia, in other words, people who can't form new memories because of damage to the hippocampus, which is the key area for memory in the brain. They also have problems in imagining future scenarios. And this fits together with some other research suggesting that the same parts of the brain are involved when we think about the past, but also when we construct new scenarios, when we imagine new scenarios about how things might be in the future. Basically, the same core system seems to get recruited. And this core system seems to sort of just chuck out a lot of, you know, alternative scenarios that could be about what happened in the past. They could be things that will happen in the future. And the element of pastness to the memory is kind of almost a separate thing that gets added later.
You mentioned in the book, and tell me if I've got this wrong, but almost that from an evolutionary perspective, our ability to form memories is almost a byproduct of our ability. It was more, from an evolutionary perspective, it's more important for us to be able to plan for the future.
That's right. That's a big driving force behind this new approach to understanding memory. It's asking, what is memory for? Why did it evolve? What's the point of being able to remember your first day at school? What's the point of being able to have all these vivid memories of stuff that's happened, that's gone, that's, you know, passed? The point is, it's useful for the future. And so one of the things it might allow us to do is, based on information about what's happened to us in the past, we might be able to plan for particular scenarios, plan for circumstances that might unfold, remember those scenarios, carry them forward until that thing actually happens, and then we know what to do because we've planned for it. You know, we've thought about what's going to happen next, and we can recall those scenarios and act accordingly. That makes much more sense from an evolutionary point of view. It makes much more sense to imagine that our memory system evolved to be recombinative and creative because it allows us to work out what's going to happen next. Now, the corollary of that is that we're going to have a very faulty memory system. Because if our memories are constantly recombining and pulling in information from different places and putting it together in different ways at different times, pulling in bits of information that shouldn't be in the memory very often, that's where memory errors come from. So that's the guiding principle, really, of the modern science of memory, that by studying the errors that we make with memory, we can actually learn a lot about how this machine works.
So we've been talking in the main about Pieces of Light, the new science of memory, which is Charles Fernyhough's book, which is out now, and it's out from Profile Books. But I also want to talk to you, Charles, about A Box of Birds, which is a novel that's coming out from the Unbound stable.
It will be available to subscribers before the end of the year, and it will be published in its trade edition in the spring.
This book is about, it's a novel, but it's based around the themes of memory and neuroscience. So, well, tell us about what it's about, and then tell us why you wanted to write about these subjects from like a fictional perspective.
Yeah, A Box of Birds is about a young neuroscientist and her relationship with two of her students. One of them is this sort of brilliant, unstable whiz kid who's obsessed with the material basis of memory and tries to get her involved in a complicated scheme to put this into action. The other is a shadowy but dangerously attractive character who seems to be an animal rights campaigner, actually turns out to be representing a much more sinister organization. And I was interested in writing about a neuroscientist because I saw the way that our culture is being steeped in neuroscience. You know, we are lapping this stuff up. We can't get enough of brain images and stories about how different bits of our brain do different things and explain everything about who we are. That's not to knock the neuroscience that the scientists are doing, because they're doing really good stuff, and for the most part they're not going too far with their interpretations of it. But culturally, in the wider culture, in the wider context of popular journalism and so on, we see all sorts of overplaying of neuroscientific findings. What I wanted to do was say, what if you had somebody who was steeped in this kind of way of understanding the mind? She really believed there was nothing more to her experience than neurons and chemicals and neural activity. How would that change the way she saw herself? How would that change her interpretation of her own experience and her own feelings? And crucially, how would it affect how she acted? How would it affect the moral choices that a character in a novel makes? And that's where the story came from.
I just want to talk very briefly before we finish just about what the experience has been like publishing it through the Unbound route. You know, this is like a crowd-funded way of funding, and obviously Pieces of Light has been produced by a more traditional publishing route. So what's the sort of contrast of the two experiences?
The main difference is that you do things back to front. Rather than publishing the novel and then trying to get publicity, you do it the other way around. You try and get the interest in the novel before the novel actually happens. And that seemed to be a perfect way of approaching this book, because it touches on so many issues that we're engaged with at the moment. What difference is neuroscience making to our understanding of ourselves? Is it going to change things in the way that psychoanalysis and Darwinism change things? in the late 19th and early 20th century? Is it going to really make a difference? Is there going to be a paradigm shift in how we understand ourselves? This is what this book is about. But it's also about other things to do with the ethics of research and animal experimentation and the ownership of data and all sorts of juicy scientific and cultural topics that, I thought people would get interested in, and we could get some conversations going about the book as a way of getting the book produced.
That's a good point for us to end. So I've been talking to Charles Fernie-Ho. Charles, thank you for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.